All your base and superstructure belong to us.
Hello, and welcome to part 27 of our Understanding Class series. Today is Thursday the 20th of April, 2023, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. We begin Chapter 8, The Death of Class Debate. This week, I have the new patron, Paul Griffin, to thank. If you'd like to help support the show, please head on over to the Patreon, where you get access to all those patron-only episodes and the Discord server. And if you'd like to find out more about the Socialist Planning Book project that Donal and myself are busy writing, head on over to theclassessocietyinmotion.com, where you can find links and how to support the project. The links to the slides for this episode are, as ever, in the show notes. Okay, to the discussion.
Okay, Kyle, keep going here.
All right, second proposition, the proposition of group formation. Point one. Classes are more than statistical aggregates or taxonomic categories. Point two, they are real features of social structure reflected in observable patterns of inequality, association, and distance, which I believe he means social distance here. Like how many degrees of separation do you have? And then Point three, so deep and fundamental are these cleavages that they form the principal and enduring basis for conflict and contestation. As before, the first two statements correctly identify commitments of most class analysts. The third statement, however, would be rejected by virtually all Weberian class analysts, and many contemporary Marxists would also demur from the statement in this unqualified and categorical form. Although most Marxists would argue that even when class formation and class struggle have been contained, there will continue to be effects of class relations on other forms of conflict, this does not imply the stronger claim that class cleavages constitute the principal basis for all conflict. To claim enduring and even pervasive effects is not to claim class primacy.
Yeah. I think that speaks to what we were talking about before. And so if you have this notion of class, you do have to confront that there is this version of Marxism that, you know, doesn't do the cool expansion of the base and still thinks this explains everything.
It's like in early Marxist historiography, like when Marxists first sort of like got into history departments and wanted to find out how every historical conflict in history could be reduced to a class conflict. That's sort of the approach that number three is pointing out.
Can you give counterexamples for people who are listening here, Kyle, that might be thinking, well, what historical stuff were we thinking like class wasn't the principal basis for a conflict?
You know, like the conflict between the English and Scottish crowns over a number of times. Like, you know, there are dynastic struggles there. There are certainly economic elements to the struggles, but like, does having one king or the other fundamentally about class? Not really, no. Like, you can't really say that.
To what extent is colonialism about class? Because I think it is, but you know, to what extent? Right? Like, because that's a lot of wars. That's a lot of shit, right? Like, and it's not like there's no labor aspects to colonialism. There always is. Whether it's, hey, let's enslave these people, or hey, let's kill all these people so we can, you know, take their resources or something. I guess that's not exactly labor, but that's still part of the economic, you know, realm, I suppose.
Right. And so are we extracting those economic processes from class?
No, I mean, I think the thing is, like, just as I was saying before, like, you can have struggles over the surplus that are not about class divisions, right? Because the surplus has already been extracted, and there's, like, the question of sort of rentier distribution among social categories. You can have conflicts that are about that secondary distribution and not about extraction. in the first instance, right? Like, there's a lot of conflicts in feudalism that are not about the question of whether or not the peasantry should provide X amount of surplus to everybody else.
But could they be about, like, say, that if your lord was dominant over another lord, that they would be able to extract more surplus and that would benefit where you live, say, to a certain extent?
Totally. Absolutely, right? Because then it's a question of, like, within the nobility, how is the surplus being distributed? And then how are there, like, secondary benefits to everybody else who is a part of that domain?
I don't know if I'm being dumb here, but I'm kind of trying to see how that wouldn't even, why we wouldn't constitute that as some kind of class battle.
I don't think that's dumb. I think this is a hard question, and that's why I'm kind of for Wright's argument that, yeah, you know, Marxists might disagree on this stuff.
Yeah, and I think, like, basically what I'm saying is you can have intra-class conflicts within dominant classes that are of historic, like, significant historical scope, right? That isn't about defining a particular boundary of extraction from labor. And then you can also have conflicts between social groups that are both dominant in the sense that they are not the ones performing the primary surplus production in society, right? So, like, you could have a conflict between, say, the feudal lords and the church. Like, neither of them are actually producing the surplus. They're both parasitic on the surplus production, but they do have real conflicts with each other. And those do have, like, actual historical scope to them. Like, they're significant conflicts. They're not just, like, petty things that aren't worth writing about.
Okay, so let's hit the next one then. Esri, do you want to hit more of these propositions?
One, the proposition of causal linkage. Class membership is also causally connected. Consciousness, identity, an action outside the arena of economic production. Two, it affects political preferences, lifestyle choices, child-rearing practices, opportunities for physical and mental health, access to educational opportunity, patterns of marriage, occupational inheritance, income, and so on. This proposition is sound, since Bukulski and Waters do not assert here that class must be the primary causal determinant of each of the exponenda listed under point two. All the propositions therefore assert that access to economically relevant assets has a systematic effect, direct or indirect, on these kinds of phenomena. Wright wishes to add one caveat. The list of phenomena for which classes claim to have effects is almost completely open-ended. Most class analysts would qualify the proposition of causal linkage by saying that class matters more for some phenomena than others, and that for certain exponenda, class might have negligible effects. Furthermore, the extent to which class matters for various exponenda may itself be contingent upon various other variables, i.e., there may be strong interactive effects between the micro-level effects of class location and various macro-level processes. Class analysis would not disappear as a legitimate research program if, for some of these exponenda, it turns out that class determinants were weak.
Okay, this seems all very uncontroversial. Do people agree?
Class is back, baby. Like, Wright wrote this book after a period where this stuff was out there. It's kind of not out there since then. No one's saying death of class now.
Yeah, you would have to be off your rocker. Like, it's staring you in the face, like, literally everywhere you go.
Yeah, you can see, like, that the leftists have taken over, like, Twitter, and they're getting, like, the advertisers to stop paying, you know, like, it's all kicking off.
Right, of course, yeah.
Those damn activists.
the cultural rappers have taken over Twitter and destroyed Elon Musk.
Well, thank God that Elon Musk is saving us from the cultural Marxist postmodernist menace. Like
right before the election.
And he's going to save free speech.
I'm willing to make a pact here now. Like, we should all just give up Twitter just to kill him, just to burn him.
I already did it, Tom.
I've never been on Twitter.
Good. Just Facebook.
I'm going to continue to tweet bullshit. I'm sorry.
Boo!
You just got to find another microblogging platform to use.
I tried Mastodon, but like, I don't know who to hang out with. I know who not to hang out with.
I don't think Twitter is long for this world. I'm
getting that feeling too. I certainly hope so. It's not been a good influence on anyone I know.
The day that the Queen died was the best Twitter day ever.
Oh yeah,
it was like just like the springtime of the people on Twitter, and it was so good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like the memes were fucking fantastic.
It's all downhill from there.
Do you honestly think it could go bust? It could.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. If he
overmanages it and does a really poor job and is like obviously like very hypocritical on how, I'm free speech, but then he silences anyone who criticizes him, then yeah, like people aren't going to put up with that.
Well, that's factored already.
They laid off half the workforce. Yesterday.
Yeah, the management stuff going on. Actually, it's kind of funny. A lot of tech people who pay attention to finance have been like, "Hey, you know, there's big layoffs coming," and so this is very interesting. Elon Musk is, you know, kind of concentrated that thought into one human being and just arbitrarily laid off half the workforce, including. Well, some not so arbitrary stuff like the human rights department, let's say. It will be interesting to see what his plans are, because I think it's going to look, it's more or less going to make Truth Social obsolete and may make Twitter kind of. And look, we all know Twitter is for two types of people that will tell you to kill yourself. One of them is blue hair and the other, you know, has like a permanent Roman salute on their arm. And so it might just become a platform for one of those types of people. And that would probably kill it.
Just the new parlor is really what I expect out of Twitter.
You know, Twitter, it's a weird one because like even the people who are really good on Twitter, that they're shit posters or whatever, they all seem to have a hatred for Twitter.
Well, it fries their brains. Like, it hurts them and their instincts cry out against it.
So, like, all it's taken is, like, just somebody to make them go, right, this is the final fucking straw. And without the shit posters, Twitter's nothing.
Well, it's taking away the one thing that was rewarding about it to them. The dopamine kind of feedback loop. If they're, like, silenced on it, or if people who criticize Elon Musk are silenced on it, then, like, what's the fucking point? There's nothing there for them. It just hurts them.
If you can't make dank Elon Musk divorce jokes, then what's the point of Twitter? Like, really?
Like, so there's been a number of blue ticks have been changing their, you know, their whatever, their handle to Elon Musk, and then like a picture of Elon Musk and saying things like, I drink my own urine, it makes my brain work better. And then like they've since got their accounts suspended, you know, even the blue ticks are going, fuck this shit. Gotta love it. Okay. Next one. So take the last of these propositions there, Ezri. Keep going.
All right. The propositions of transformative capacity. 1. Classes are potential collective actors in economic and political fields. 2. Insofar as they consciously struggle against other classes, classes can transform the general set of social arrangements of which they are a part. 3. Class therefore offers the dynamic thrust that energizes society. 4. Classes are the principal collective actors that can make history. Statement 1 accurately characterizes most forms of class analysis. Wright would only modify it in one respect. Except metaphorically, Classes as such are never literally collective actors. It is organizations like political parties and unions that act strategically in economic and political fields, not the classes themselves.
Okay, so I put a little bracket like saying here, is this true? Like if we look, say, at the whole thing of like, say, the George Floyd riots and stuff and protests, like they're not really political parties, unions acting strategically or anything.
That's right.
It seems like just a raw class as a class, not in the sense of which Wright is saying here.
Is a riot in response to a racist police shooting part of the base or not? Right.
Like,
that's sort of a question that will help you answer that more or less, because I think it is. Obviously, this is what expansion of the base people say. And therefore, it's not just organizations that are capable of constituting some sort of, you know, will of collective actor. There is an emergent possibility there.
Like, the Paris mob was not, quote unquote, a organization, you know, like it was an actor in history, but it was not organized in the sense that a political party in the modern way or union is. These things are typically quite short-lived, right? These sort of like class as a disorganized class acting are generally quite short-lived, but doesn't mean they can't make history. That's kind of silly.
Right, but perhaps the claim is more like, but they're, because they're not an organization, they don't like speak with one voice. It's just an aggregate of individual wills.
So I think I think it's most accurate perhaps to think of the like political parties and unions as being more potential representatives, and to the extent to which they are good or bad representatives of class interests is in question. Some would argue that they're always bad. I think political parties personally are usually a little bit more sus than unions, although unions can be quite suspect. But they have the benefit of having a structural longevity, whereas, well, a riot and protests and things like that, the Paris mob, are more pure expressions of class interests. Like Kyle pointed out, they're quite short-lived. They're quite short-lived, but they are more often than unions or parties, I would argue, more often they make history. It's usually the mob that makes a decisive, you know, kind of mark the beginning of a revolution more than a party.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I'm still chewing on the collective, the sort of like unity of action principle that happens when you're in a formal organization with longevity versus, you know, when you are at an autonomous protest. You know, there's no even like, I don't know, if you're part of some sort of organization, there is a certain, you know, level of protocol where you agree to, it's not exactly democratic centralism, but, you know, you agree to be part of the organization even when you're dissenting, more or less. Therefore, you're kind of like part of what the organization is doing in some kind of corporate way. I guess really this distinction rises and falls on how real that is to you. Whereas in an autonomous protest, things may happen that not only, you know, you may like oppose or disagree with, or it's not what you would do, but there's actually no corporate body, right, that guarantees some kind of you know, relationship between you and the situation, I suppose.
Yeah, the conditions for its reproduction as a social entity are quite precarious.
Yeah, and it's capable of acting in a way that others aren't. Like, I don't know, it's like when the Bolsheviks used to do bank robberies, right? Like, the party needed them, but there was actually a bunch of people that were genuinely against the bank robberies and kind of wished they would stop, but they couldn't stop it. And so, as part of the organization, they were still kind of complicit. Whereas if you're just in a big mob and, you know, someone breaks into the, like, let's say, you know, there is an autonomous action and, you know, a break off of the Paris Commune breaks into the Bank of Paris following the world historic advice of Marx and Engels. I guess the Paris Commune's a bad example because it's more organized than a regular mob. But if, you know, that happened now, like, I don't know, if a football team lost in Europe and there's just a big mob and, you know, some of them broke into the Bank of Paris, right? Very plausibly, a bunch of people involved with it, you know, would not be complicit with robbing the Bank of Paris in a way that a Bolshevik party member is sort of complicit, even though it's, you know, they didn't like agree to it. There's this organizational bound that has continuity. And so these things are related, I think.
I think it's like you do get instances of collective punishment where, like, you know, classes as classes are punished with just all the killing and after the Paris Commune and that kind of stuff. But it's typically a matter of like political expediency more than it is of like justified jurisprudence, you know, like, oh, like you can't really like say like every member of the working class in Paris deserve to die because of their participation in the commune. But as a matter of suppressing that class for like decades, that was like seen to be politically expedient. And so, you know, just let loose the dogs of war, right? It's a different kind of responsibility that's attributed to participants.
It's funny you should mention the Bolshevik bank robberies. I don't know if any of you remember, there was like a massive bank robbery in Belfast in 2004. And supposedly it was the IRA, and what they were going to use the cash for was for basically paying off. Like if you were like some IRA guy who was probably doing some like robberies and shit to raise funds and taking a cut on the side, this was like supposed to like pay off all of these like kind of people around. But they robbed so much money in this one bank job, it was too much for them to wash. They robbed, I think, £26 million in cash. Can you imagine? They filled up a truck with cash, and then they came back and filled it up again. They filled up a truck.
Whoa! Right? They went back for seconds.
Yeah, and you want to see where they did it. It was like right in the center of like an alley off the main square in Belfast. I mean, it was like robbing like from downtown fucking Manhattan just off Wall Street on an alleyway. And they filled it up, and it got so much that they had to get the money. They had to like hide it all over the place. Like hiding £26 million in like £10 notes is fucking a big job. And there was one guy about a week later in Cork. And, you know, which was like 300 miles from where the robbery was done. And he got nervous. He'd obviously got his hands on some of the cash. They'd given him some of this cash. And he got nervous. And he burnt it. And he put it into his fireplace. And he thought the guards were coming for him. So he burnt it. But didn't it, like, with the heat of the fire, when he put in the money, it sucked all the money up out of the chimney. And it went all over the neighborhood.
Oh my god.
So there was like fucking like £100,000 in fucking tenors in British £10 notes floating around. He literally made it rain.
That's a better way to get rid of it than fucking burning it. It's going to some good use.
Yeah.
I will say that that's a powerful argument for, you know, one person constituting the collective will, I suppose.
What do you mean?
They say history isn't made by great men. I don't know.
they robbed a bank and sort of comically accidentally distributed it among the masses. I mean, that...
I'm looking at it here. Like, there's a big... I think nobody got sent down for it. I don't think...
Sometimes there is justice in this world, Tom.
What's the fuck up?
Like, literally a £26 million. How good must their organizational discipline have been to not have one leak? For a £26 million robbery. Fantastic.
Bless them. For right, statement 2 would be acceptable to most strands of class analysis, so long as the word transform is taken to include something like modifications in the rules of the game and not simply revolutionary ruptures in the game itself. Statements 3 and 4 are much more contentious, because of the assertion of class primacy. While classical Marxism certainly affirmed the thesis that class struggle was the motive of history, Most contemporary Marxists would qualify such claims by stressing the importance of a variety of enabling conditions that make it possible for collectively organized class forces to have such system-shaping effects. Few Marxists believe that the collective capacity for radical transformation is automatically produced by the contradictions of capitalism. So, 2, 3, 4.
What do we think?
I think that, like, you know, it's more that the contradictions of capitalism produce the potential for collective capacity, but they don't produce collective capacity automatically. Like, capacity as, like, a real, like, agency, a capacity to act effectively, it does not produce that automatically.
I think Wright is really good at, like, when you're looking at any piece of work, you really want to grill the assumptions going into it. And so if you have to assert statements 3 and 4 in the more contentious sense in order to make the death of class plausible, then maybe it's because you've erected a straw man. Although we all know with Marxism that there are many walking straw men who exit the feedback loops and keep that opinion. So,
right.
But yeah, I think Wright is more or less, you know, correct.
Straw men to the left of me, straw men to the right.
Okay. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yeah. We are centrist now, are we? There we go.
Radical centrists.
Radical centrists.
Is that
what Stalin was?
I kind of think so, yeah.
Radical center, yeah.
Sort of, yeah. Like,
yeah.
If you really take the fucking, like, Second International spectrum seriously, yeah, apparently the center is, like, you know, what the hard right would be in the Overton window or something. I don't know.
Okay. Let's hit 4 propositions. I'll do this one myself. Okay. So, while Pakulski and Waters do accurately identify some central strands in class analysis, they consistently slide from a reasonable description of propositions that affirm the relevance of class to much stronger and contentious claims about class primacy. They seem to believe that without the claim of class primacy, there would be no point at all to class analysis. For Wright, class analysis need not universally privilege class over all other social divisions in order to justify its research programs. Class analysis is premised on the view that class constitutes a salient causal structure with important ramifications. There is abundant evidence to support this claim. It is a much more contingent claim that class processes constitute the most important cause of particular social phenomena, and a far more contentious and implausible claim that they constitute the most important cause of everything. Well, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the times and when society like has had big, massive shifts, it's when class has done the action, but that, like, class is not always operative as this mega obvious driving force. Is that a reasonable way to think about it?
I think that's reasonable. I think, yeah, I kind of agree more with the expanding the base kind of definition, though, and thinking of as intersectional processes as kind of like a blending of, like, taking, for example, like the new left and the kind of like anti-racist stuff in the United States, particularly with the Black Panthers, that wasn't devoid of class. In fact, like, the way that class and race intersect and that kind of component of civil rights is quite instructive. Or more recently, like the Black Lives Matter, there isn't like an obvious economic component, but if you think more materially, there's nothing more bread and butter than being killed by cops. Like, you're dead. Right. So there is an obvious kind of material component, a base component, if you will, to that struggle.
No, the Panthers are an interesting example because they have the post-Maoist, you know, view of the lumpen in relation to Black struggle. So they have, you know, they really do frame race in terms of class in the United States in this vital way. And, you know, if I made it sound like all the intersectionalists, post-Stalinists, were people that only saw these things as different systems, it's not true. Like, you know, there's a bunch of, like, unity theorists, like, and, you know, people that really think, you know, It's all one system of oppression, more or less.
What about something like you know, sort of a similar time, like the sexual revolution, like is a major upheaval in society, right? But is it primarily class driven?
I definitely see the material
basis for it, but I don't know if I would say it was primarily a class driven upheaval.
Well, gender is a very interesting case because I think the way Esri put it earlier, well, it's fascinating as like a consumer good. You have different problems with sexual-based oppression or gender-based oppression and different economic class strata. And you have access to different privileges and rights based on what class you're in.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And like, you know, as far as like the hippies went, there were lots of people who said, oh, they're all just like middle class.
Right.
There was definitely like a class perspective on the sexual revolution. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it was primarily a matter of class conflict. It just seems like something that was animated by a lot of class conflict that was going on around it at the same time, as well as some material conditions that were very peculiar to that situation.
Well, yeah, is sex, you know, class, right? Like, is control of the means of human reproduction and, you know, the birth, like, sexual revolution is not possible without birth control, right? Like,
it's not possible without birth control. I don't think it's possible without the baby boom either, you know? I don't think it would have happened without the baby boom.
What do you mean by that, Kyle?
There's just so many young people who are like open to changing society at that period of time, at the same time that birth control becomes a reality and an availability. And so it's like suppressing it was a lot less plausible than if you had, say, like, you know, in more recent times, like a massive boomer generation that is old and conservative and a much smaller younger generation, right?
I'm very fixated on how society changes since the 1970s and how women's relationship to labor works. And I understand that, you know, the golden age of capitalism with the class compromise where you have, you know, a housewife role, I understand that that's not like an eternal, you know, law of history, nor is it really the natural state of capitalism. There's many women that are being ground down by the, you know, factories Marx was talking about in Capital. But since the 1970s, the relationship between women and reproductive labor has been severed because of a new technological capacity that is distributed on a class basis, among other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're right that it's not maybe the primary driver if you're talking about Erkel and Wright's version of class as endoclass, as outside the productive economic unit. But if you are folding in internal reproductive relations into the base, which I am in favor of, then I think it's, I don't know. You know, it actually assails the foundations of class.
Yes. Yes, yes, that's true. That is true. Yeah, like, I think it's just hard for me to say it was primarily a class phenomenon, even though, like, class was very deeply implicated in everything about it.
Yeah, it's not primarily an exoclass phenomenon. So, yes, in that respect, I agree.
Wait, now we've had endoclass and exoclass. Explain these.
That's my own pet jargon for trying to think of class relations in the normal sense as exoclass outside of the economic unit. Traditionally, class is between economic units, and gender, for the most part, including queer shit, as long as people aren't being thrown out of their homes for being queer, is internal to the economic unit. It always is, you know, 50% of the bourgeoisie are women, you know, like, it's just how it's going to be, you know, unless NB's really make some ground, and then, you know, then it'll be 45% or something.
Bourgeois NB's of the world reunite.
Shit.
No. No.
And beings cannot even unite amongst themselves, let alone on a class. Perhaps only class spaces can bring them together. And exo-class spaces. Pardon me. I'm being a little bit of a rad femme this evening.
Rad femme.
If you'd like to help fund the book that Donald and myself are writing about communist economic planning, please head over to the website theclasslesssocietyinmotion.com, where you can donate to our fund to help us get this book out in a finite time. Everybody who donates will get a signed copy of the book when it's released. So head on over there today and help us with this really important project. This show is a member of the Emancipation Network, a Marxist podcast and research collective. Make sure to check out our network sister podcasts, General Intellect Unit, Jumpsuit Utopia, Mortal Science, and Swampside Chats. And if you'd like to help out the show, please remember to head over to Patreon and throw me a few commie dollar. On this episode, you heard the theme tune The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters and Night of the Purple Moon by Sun Ra and his orchestra. Thank you for listening, and please join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega. ¶¶